In a few moments, you'll experience the live stream from LifePoint Church. I'm so glad that you're here to join us for that experience. At our church, our mission is to influence people to find and follow Jesus. We want to see people find Jesus, in other words, believe in him for their salvation. And then after that, we want to see those believers follow Christ in a life of wholehearted devotion. All of our energy and effort is put into serving you, helping you experience that. So maybe you're joining us from another part of the world or another state in the United States. We're glad that you're here. My encouragement to you would be wherever you are in the world, find a local body of believers to get involved with. Don't let this be your church alone. And then for those of you that are in our local area or maybe even part of our church family, perhaps some of you are on vacation or some of you have kids that are sick or for whatever reason you decided to stay in this weekend. And I would just invite you to consider not using our live stream as a substitute for the church experience. Make sure you're involved in community. We have the wonder of technology to take advantage of experiencing a service through computer and in our own homes, but that's not the church. I would invite you to come and be part of community. You can do that especially through small groups here at our church. I would invite you to get connected with people, share life together, be part of what God is doing in each other's lives. It's a very powerful thing. And then, of course, as you're watching via live stream, I would invite you to participate in the act of worship through giving. I would encourage you to go on to our website, lifepointchurch.us. There you can find a tab to click, and you can be a part of this experience through the giving of your gifts. My deepest prayer is that God would use the experience of this service to change you, to draw you closer to himself. I hope you enjoy this time together.
That was Mary Roach, American Idol season 4, back from 2005. We dug that out of the archives. And every single person that I show that video to has the same response that we all have when we watch it this morning. It's super uncomfortable, isn't it? It's just crazy. You can feel the tension in the room. But I think that's fantastic because what that video does, it taps in to our emotions as people in a really deep way. And I think our emotions are the dashboard lights of our lives. They show us that there's something more going on there. And I think we're going to use that video as we go through our ideas this morning that we're going to talk about. But I need to break down the video a little bit because I think it's really descriptive for the things we're going to talk about. Mary kind of goes through three different stages in that video. First stage, clearly, she is not aware of how she actually sings. Right? She's a little confused at the beginning. She says, my vocal style, it's kind of a mix of pop meets rock meets rhythm and blues meets jazz meets Broadway. That's like every musical genre there is, okay? And it's friendly. I'm gonna change my name when I do this. And then she starts to sing. And you see the judges just kind of looking at each other like, is this real? Like, is this like really happening? And then we go to stage 2. She finishes singing. And there's this kind of state of disbelief on the part of the judges. And Simon asks this question, how do you think you did? And she says, 8 out of 10. She clearly has no idea how she sings. And then Simon Cowell drops the bomb. Now it's a time bomb. He says, honestly, really long pause, you're one of the worst singers I've ever heard in my whole life. Right? And we know that's true. And yet it bounces off. It bounces off of her. She says, do you really think that? I think you're trying to give me a hard time, right? I think you're kidding around. He goes, no, really. And then he asks her, so what made you audition for this competition? And do you remember her response? She said, you know, all my friends told me I was an awesome singer. And one of my favorite comments in the video, Randy Jackson is off camera. He goes, what? How could that be true, right? Stage 3 then, Mary goes through stage 3 is her response. Now, in the video that we saw, she was sad, clearly. She was upset. She was hurt. But she was pretty rational, and she wasn't kind of out of line or anything. But we edited the video. This is church. And we cut out the part where she leaves the audition room, goes out in the hallway, and just starts cussing out the judges, okay? Really profound response. So my name's Mark Martin. I'm an elder here at LifePoint Church. For my day job, I'm a professor at UMBC. And we are in the middle of a summer series called Relatable. In other words, we're talking about how we can be able to relate well to other people. And the goal really is to combine strong biblical content with very practical application that we can use to build and improve our relationships with other people. And if you haven't figured it out yet today, our topic is self-awareness. Self-awareness. And a shout out to Brad Linderman, who pointed me to this book a couple months ago. Great book. It's called Insight: The Surprising Truth About How Others See Us, How We See Ourselves, and Why the Answers Matter More Than We Think, by Tasha Urich, back from 2017. So she defines this idea of self-awareness in the book. She says, at its core, it's the ability to see ourselves clearly. The ability to see ourselves clearly. She goes on to say, it's really to understand who we are, how others see us, and how we fit into the world. And in the book, she shows, using pretty strong scientific evidence, that people who are self-aware are happier, they make smarter decisions, they're better at personal and professional relationships, they're more creative, they're more confident, they're better communicators who get more promotions, they're better leaders, they're more enthusiastic employees, and the list just keeps going on and on and on of the benefits of being self-aware. She says that self-awareness really sets the upper limit for the skills that make us better people and with the kind of things that we need today. It's stronger leaders, better relationships, and even small gains in self-awareness can have this big payoff. So I would suggest this morning that self-awareness really is the foundation to being relate-able, to being able to relate to others. If we don't understand who we are, we're not going to do a good job relating to other people. And I like to think in word pictures, and one that came to mind for me with this whole topic was the idea of fixing a car. If you take your car to a mechanic today, the first thing they do is they'll plug it into a diagnostic computer, and the computer will get codes off the car. The car is telling the computer what it thinks is wrong. You know, what are the different problems that it's had? So that doesn't exactly tell the mechanic how to fix the car, but it's a great start because now you know what the problems are, and the mechanic can say, okay, well, those problems mean that this is the fix we need to apply. I think the same thing's true for us. We don't have a diagnostic computer, but I think if we're self-aware, it allows us to see what are the things in our life, what are the error codes, if you will, in our lives? Where are we singing off key and not aware of it? Where are we singing off key? Because then we can start to take steps to get it fixed and to do better. So just like Mary Roach, I think there's a number of people in the Bible who are singing off key and don't know it. A great example is Simon Peter. So I would suggest that he was impulsive. He was self-assertive, he was proud, at times even brash. And it sure looks to me like Simon Peter was singing off key for pretty much the entire time he was with Jesus and was unaware of it. Just a few examples here. So Jesus, and you are probably familiar with some of these stories, had just fed 5,000 people. He had to put in a full day's work, he was tired. And so his disciples were fishermen, so he put them in a boat, sent them off across the lake so he could have some, you know, downtime where he could relax and rest and pray. But then he wanted to reconnect with them. Well, they took the boat. So, of course, he's God. And so to get to them, he walks across the water out to the boat. So the text tells us it was shortly before dawn when this happened. So I don't know, like 4 o'clock in the morning. And I don't know how relevant you are at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm not sure the disciples were completely aware of what's going on. They thought it was a ghost. And so Peter yells out from the boat and, Lord, if it's you, that's my favorite part, right? Because if it's you, God, I'm not sure it is, tell me to come out on the water. And so I'm just imagining all his friends, the other disciples, are like, Peter, like, what are you doing? This is crazy. But of course, Jesus invites him out. Peter walks on the water. You may know the rest of the story. He sings. Jesus pulls him up and so forth. There's another time Jesus is talking to his disciples. He says, who do people say that I am? Who do people say that I am? And I can just imagine now the disciples there, and Peter's like, ooh, I know that one. I know that one. I got it. You're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And Jesus is like, yes, that's right, Peter. Simon, son of Jonah, you are Peter, now I'm changing your name. And I'm just imagining Peter's response. He's like, yes, nailed it. Got a name change in the process. Okay. Right after that, Jesus is having a very somber moment with the disciples. And he says, you know, I have to suffer and die. He's explaining why he came to earth. And this is astounding. So Peter pulls Jesus aside, okay? The text says that Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. So here's Peter rebuking God. And he says, never, Lord, never, Lord. He said, this shall never happen to you. And you may know the rest of the story. Jesus said, you know, get behind me, Satan. You know, stop with that stuff. Another famous example of Peter's impulsiveness. So Peter, James, and John, really three of Jesus' key disciples, are with him on this very high mountain. And Jesus goes through something called the Transfiguration. So he starts to like glow. You know, the text says his clothes were bleach or whiter than any bleach could get him. It's like sunshine coming off of him, if you will. And they are petrified. And then to make matters even crazier, Elijah and Moses show up. And so the three disciples are watching this, kind of freaked out. So impulsive Peter interrupts the conversation and he says, hey, Rabbi, it's really good we're here. And I'm just imagining, you know, Jesus, Elijah, and Moses kind of like, what? It's really glad you're here. We'll put up tents for you. And I can put up one for Moses and Elijah too. And just crazy impulsive Peter. So then at the Last Supper, Jesus was explaining to his disciples what was going to come next. It was the end of his ministry. He was preparing them for what was going to happen. And there's this amazing exchange between Jesus and Peter in Matthew 26. So Jesus told them, this very night, you will all fall away on account of me. You will all fall away on account of me. So why did Jesus say that? I'm not sure exactly, but I think it was to prepare them so they knew what was going to happen. It would soften the fall a little bit when it happened. Now, this is, again, it's astounding. Impulsive Peter comes back. Even if all fall away, he's not in the all. Even if all fall away, I never will. And I'm just imagining Jesus, oh, Peter, really? Seriously? So tell you what, this very night before a rooster crows, you're going to disown me three times. So Peter doesn't get the hint. He doubles down on the bet. He doubles down and he says, even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. And I'm just imagining the eye roll, right, that's going on with Jesus. And the other disciples are probably like, dude, what are you talking about, guy? Come on. So I think it's interesting to kind of analyze this whole exchange. Now, not every story that we know about Jesus is in all four Gospels, but this one is. And I think that implies that this is actually very important for us to know about and to understand. So why did this happen? Well, Peter pushed back because he's impulsive. And if you think about the process that happened here, Peter said, I'm going to die for you. I'll never disown you. Do you think when Peter said that, did he believe it? Did he believe what he said? Sure he did. Of course he did. He was certain that it was true. When Mary Roach walked into that audition, did she think she was a good singer? Of course she did. She thought she was singing 8 out of 10. But both Peter and Mary were singing off key and they didn't know it. They didn't know it. I think this is actually pretty fascinating. In Luke 22:38, there's this one text at the very end of the Last Supper. It says, see, Lord, here are two swords. So we're not sure exactly who said that, but there were two swords. Maybe they were just in the room when they got there. And Jesus replies, that's enough. And that could be interpreted many ways. One way to interpret would be, that's enough. We only need two swords to defend ourselves. But that would be completely inconsistent with everything Jesus has been doing for the last 3 years. The other way to interpret is, that's enough, guys. Come on, swords. Like, do we do swords? Like, we haven't done swords. We're like, you guys are fishermen. I'm about God. We don't do swords. That's enough. Leave the swords alone. Leave them alone. Let's go. But we know that somebody took one of the swords with them when they left. Do you know who took a sword? Peter took a sword. And the reason we know that is because they went up to pray. And when they were done praying, an arresting party came to arrest Jesus. And as the party approaches, Peter whips out a sword and cuts off one of the slaves' ears. His name was Malchus, cuts off his ear. This is pretty interesting to think about, right? So what was Peter's profession? He was a fisherman, yeah. So how much sword play and practice had Peter put in? Probably not very much. So if you wanted, I don't know, I'm not a sword guy, but I'm imagining it pretty hard to cut off somebody's ear. That's a small target. I don't think he was aiming for his ear. I think Peter wanted to cut off his head, and he missed, okay? It's a good thing, because Jesus then glued the ear back on, you know, miraculously, and imagining if Peter did cut off his head and Jesus putting the head back on. That's a word picture there. But why did Peter do that? Why did he take out the sword? He had doubled down on the bet. He had said, I'll never disown you. I'll die for you. I think he was trying to prove to Jesus, hey, this is who I am. This is what I'm going to do. You're wrong. You're wrong, Jesus. I'm not going to die. I'm going to fight for you with the sword. But many of you probably know the rest of the story. As Jesus is taken down to the court of the high priest, Peter follows in the distance. He's outside the court, and there's a fire. He's warming himself. A slave girl comes up and says, hey, you were with them, weren't you? And he denies it. No, I don't know what you're talking about. And then he comes inside, and somebody says again to him, hey, you were with them. And he denies it with an oath. He kind of ratchets it up a little bit. And then finally somebody else says, yeah, you were definitely with them. You were. And one of these people that confronted him was a relative of the guy's ear who had been cut off, right? So that's kind of crazy. And Peter swears, he says, no, it wasn't me. Cock-a-doodle-doo. And it says in the text that he looked over and he saw Jesus staring back. And his response was he wept bitterly and he ran out. Now, we don't have time to unpack the rest of the story, but eventually Peter's restored. There's a breakfast on the beach. Peter reconnects with Jesus and goes on to have this incredible ministry. Well, it's really interesting to go back to the Last Supper and look more at what Jesus said. He prepared Peter. He really did. He warned him ahead of time it was going to happen. He was very specific. He said it was going to happen 3 times. He gave him this auditory cue, you know, cock-a-doodle-doo. And there's more, actually. In Luke 22, it says, Jesus is talking, he says, Simon, 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 behold, Satan has demanded permission to sift you like wheat. Satan has demanded permission. So that means that Jesus had a conversation with Satan. Satan said, hey, I want to test Peter's faith. And Jesus said, okay. He didn't have to say okay, but he did. Why did Jesus say okay? Because he had been living with this guy for 3 years. Peter was singing off key and didn't know it. Jesus knew that he needed a shakeup to understand how he was singing off key before he could get things right. So here's one point. I think God cares more about our character than our comfort. I think God cares more about your character than your comfort. He certainly did with Peter. He certainly did with Peter. This is a powerful idea that's communicated throughout the New Testament, that what God receives out of our lives and what we receive out of our lives as well is the person that we become. It's the person we become. In fact, men and women, that is God's project for your life. God's project is to help you become a good person. God's project is to help you conform to the character of Christ. God doesn't care so much about what you do. He cares about who you become. And self-awareness, men and women, is the doorway through which we must walk to approach improving or becoming like Christ, to getting the character of Christ. So just like Mary Roach and Simon Peter, honestly, all of us, to some degree or another, are singing off key and we don't know it. Jeremiah knew it back in 600 BC. He said, the heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? And one of my favorite things is when science, modern science, catches up to biblical ideas or information. There's a great review article that came out a number of years ago called Flawed Self-Assessment, Implications for Health, Education, and the Workplace. So this is a 38-page literature review of the psychology literature that talks about how we as people are terrible at assessing ourselves. We're great at assessing others, but terrible at assessing ourselves. And as a result, we are not self-aware. And so we don't have time to unpack all the details here, but they actually categorize different ways this is true. So one of my favorites is the above average effect, that most of us think that we're above average, which isn't really mathematically possible. But one of my favorites is that 94% of professors think they do above average work. And as a professor, I know that I'm in that 94%. Another one that I think informs the story of Peter is called imperfect understanding of emotion. And that's the idea that you might think and feel a certain way under one set of circumstances, but when placed in a whole different set of circumstances, you behave and think differently. And the experiment they did to kind of show this was they had a psychology class, and they asked students in the class hypothetically if they were to play the funk classic Super Freak, if the students would come down to the front for $5 and dance to that song. And so I think a third of the students raised their hand, yeah, of course I would do that. So then I would have loved to have been in this class. They whipped out the $5, put them on the desk at the front of the room, and they invited students to come down. And of course, almost nobody did, right? So when it was hypothetical, sure. Now, Peter, in the upper room, it was safe. There wasn't really anybody there but Jesus and the disciples, okay? Then in the garden, maybe it feels a little safe too because all the guys are there. But when he gets to the court of the high priest, it's not safe anymore. The adversary is present. They had just arrested his leader. I think the writing was on the wall that there was going to be some serious consequences. Maybe even he'd be put to death. What was Peter thinking? He was afraid. He was afraid. So when transferred and put in a different set of circumstances, he behaved differently. Peter was singing off key, and he didn't know it. This article makes it very clear. There is a mountain of evidence that all of us, to some degree or another, are singing off key, and we don't know it. And they summarize their observations. They say this: we assert that self-assessments of skill and character tend to be much more imperfect than people suspect. Our self-assessments, the degree to which we're self-aware, if you will, of skill. What is skill? That's how we act. That's the things we do. That's the behavior we have when we talk to other people. And character. Character is what underlies skills. Character is who we are on the inside, and what we do bubbles out of that. These guys say that our skill and character, we are not self-aware. We're not self-aware. So the question comes up, what do we do about it? How can we apply this idea in our own lives? And I think looking at both Mary Roach and Simon Peter, there's a familiar pattern that emerges. That we are singing off key, they were singing off key and they didn't know it. But then at some point in time, they become aware. They become aware they're singing off key. And for both Mary and Peter, it's like a gut punch. It was profound and it hurt. And then there's a response. So I'm going to kind of walk through these briefly and talk about how we can deal with this familiar pattern. So the first question, which I think is really interesting, we're singing off key and we don't know it, but why? Why don't we know that we're singing off key? And I think one reason is something called positive illusion. Positive illusion. The psychology literature tells us that we as people have a positive illusion, which means that we generally have an unrealistically favorable attitude toward ourselves and people that are close to us. This occurs because self-evaluation involves not just data and facts, but interpretation of those things. And that we as people tend to take the rosiest possible interpretation of the facts. Mary Roach said she thought she was singing 8 out of 10. Peter in the upper room said, yeah, so I will never deny you. Our brains, one author said, are positive illusion factories. So what do we do about that? I think the first thought is just to have this in mind, that this is a possibility. In fact, it's more than that. It's a high probability that all of us struggle with this to some degree or another. And that we have to be aware of the fact that we could be under this positive illusion. And I think that it's helpful to process facts and data objectively to the greatest extent possible. Maybe that means writing things down. Maybe it means talking to a trusted friend about where things stand. And be open to the idea, this is one of my major points here, is that be open to the idea that it may be you who is singing off key. And here's a key idea. When you experience emotions, particularly negative emotions, things like anger or frustration or fear or impatience, when you experience those negative emotions, it may be that those emotions are the dashboard lights of your life. And they're indicating there's something inside that's misaligned that needs to get fixed. Be open to that idea. But there's another reason that we don't know we're singing off key, and that's because nobody will tell us. Nobody will tell us. So again, in the psychology literature, there's this principle or phenomenon called the MUM effect. MUM stands for MUM, about undesirable messages. And the experiment they did at first to figure this out is pretty interesting. They had a bunch of guys come down in the late 60s and talk about their preferences in men's deodorant and color, smell, whatever. It's a ruse. And during this preference thing, they had one of the investigators come in, run into the room and say, hey, are you Glenn Lester? And the participant says, "No, I'm not going to listen." Okay, we just got a call from his family, and there's some really bad news for Glenn Lester. To some other people, they said, "There's some really good news that Glenn Lester." So as soon as he gets here, tell him about it. So then they had an actor come in, pretend to be Glenn Lester. And they recorded whether they told him about the call and whether they told him if it was good news or bad news. Now everybody told him about the call. "Hey, your family called, Glenn. You need to call him back." Now the interesting thing is when it was good news, pretty much everybody told him, "Hey, your family called with some good news. You need to call him back." But when it was bad news, they didn't tell him that. When it was bad news, they just said, "Hey, your family called. You should call him back." So commenting on this, one author said, when we're in possession of information that might make someone uncomfortable, we tend to choose the path of least resistance. We simply decide to say nothing. I call this the food on the teeth effect, right? You've been at dinner with somebody before, and if they're an acquaintance and they have food on their teeth, like, you don't know what to say. It's just weird and uncomfortable. And a lot of times, if I'm honest, I'll admit that maybe I didn't say anything about it because of this phenomenon, the mum effect. So how do we apply that? I have a lot to talk about here, but briefly, I think we need to give our trusted friends license to tell us the truth. We need to say to our friends and colleagues and family, "Hey, I really want to hear the truth, and I will listen to that." I think if you have an opportunity to get anonymous feedback, perhaps at work or through other means, that's fantastic, because people have no hesitation to tell you the truth if it's anonymous. In the book that Tasha Urich wrote, there's this great idea, which I have not tried yet, but I think it's brilliant. She calls it the dinner of truth. And the idea here is that you pick a friend, family member, a mentor, someone who knows you well, okay? You invite them to a meal, and then you proceed the conversation with a couple ideas. You say that, "I want to learn about who I am. I want to grow in my self-awareness. And there's nothing off limits. You can say anything you want, and I will not talk back. I'm only allowed to listen. I'm not allowed to talk back." And you ask them this question: "What's the one thing that I do that annoys you the most?" "I'm going to try that. I don't know when, but I'll come back with a report. You might want to try it too." So I think the problem is that once we do hear the truth, it often feels like a gut punch. It certainly did for Mary and for Peter. And one of the first times I felt like a gut punch when I learned the truth was back in 1990. I was with my small group. I was in graduate school. We were going through a book called Search for Significance by Robert McGee. The book's been in print for over 35 years, millions and millions of copies sold. One of the most transformative books I've ever gone through. And my wife and I have gone through this book with dozens of college students over the years. And the premise of the book is essentially there's four different lies that we often believe in inappropriately. And one of those lies is called the blame game. The blame game says that those who fail, including myself, are unworthy of love and deserve to be punished. So that's a lie. And so the book actually is half book, half workbook. And in the workbook, there's a pretest you can take to see how badly you struggle with these different lies. And so I took the pretest for the blame game, and I did really well indicating or implying that I didn't have a problem with it, but God knew that I was singing off key. And so over the next several months, he allowed me to go through a whole bunch of scenarios, three in particular, where he ratcheted up, kind of knocking on my door, if you will, to let me know that I was singing off key. So the first one is kind of simple. I was in my lab. I opened the door to get some more air in the lab. And there was like one of those little doorstops that flops down and keeps the door open. And the guy who was in charge of the building, he was formerly a truck driver, but super polite, came up and said, "Mark, you can't do that because the air conditioning gets thrown off in the whole building when the doors are propped open, so you need to unprop the door." And he unpropped it, closed the door. I said, "Great." His name was Jerry. "Great, Jerry." So Jerry left 5 minutes later, propped the door back open, okay? And 10 minutes later, Jerry came by and said, "Hey, Mark, what's the deal? Like, I told you not to prop the door open. What's going on?" And I thought, who is Jerry, right? So I said, "Oh, yeah, sorry, Jerry, sorry." And so maybe half an hour later, I went to the men's room and I came back and the doorstop was gone. So I went down to the basement to Jerry's office and I learned that Jerry used to be a truck driver. He shared with me some choice thoughts that I can't share with you in church. I was still oblivious that I struggled with the blame game. So maybe a month or so later, I'm driving back from Chicago. I went to grad school at Purdue, a long, straight, flat road coming back from Chicago. And there was a guy in the left lane. I was behind him, and I wanted to punish him because he was going too slow. I know. So I put my bright lights on, maybe flashed him a couple times. And this person was in a pickup truck and became very angry. At least I'm deducing that by the fact that they slammed on the brakes, they pulled in the right lane, and they proceeded to tailgate me at the distance of about 6 inches for the next 30 miles until I got to my exit. What scared me the most was the fact that as they went by me in the other direction, I saw the gun rack in the back of the pickup truck. And so I prayed feverishly for 30 minutes, and fortunately the person didn't follow me off the exit. The crazy thing is I still didn't get it. So about a month later, I was in my lab, I was doing an assay, so I had, imagine if you will, 100 test tubes on the bench in front of me. This takes about 2 hours to do. I'm moving liquid between test tubes, and I would set it up so it would be like 3 or 4 minutes of work and a 1 minute break for 2 hours, okay? And I'm doing this assay, I might be an hour in, and there's a knock at the door. So I'm like maybe 5 or 10 seconds away from having a break, so I got up, walked over, I have a 1 minute break, I opened the door, and there was nobody there. And I thought, that's kind of dumb. Like, who plays ring and run in a lab, you know? And so I thought, okay, whatever. And I walked back, and maybe, I don't know, 15 minutes later, I'm now maybe 30 seconds away from a break, and there's another knock at the door. So now I'm working, but I'm kind of talk the whole time to keep them engaged. You know, hey, I'm doing this assay. I'm explaining what I'm doing, this assay. I got to, you know, keep going. I got 30 seconds. I'll be at the door. Eventually, those 30 seconds pass. I go to the door, open the door. Nobody's there. And then I got mad. I'm like, they deserve to be punished. Now, I didn't think that literally, okay? But that's what's going through subconsciously. I was singing off key, and I was fuming. Like, why are they doing that? So maybe 15 minutes later, again, there's a knock at the door, and I'm an hour and a half in at this point, right? I throw down my pipetter, which is trashed, you know, hour and a half of work. I run over to the door. Maybe it took me 1 second, 2 seconds. I throw open the door. There's nobody there. And I'm like, what? Like, how is that possible? I cannot explain that. It just, there wasn't enough time for someone to run away. And so I was absolutely dumbfounded. What just happened here? And so as I started to process over the next few days what happened, I think God was knocking at the door. I don't know if it was literal, but clearly he was knocking at my door. He was trying to let me know that I had been singing off key pretty much my entire life in terms of this idea that those who are guilty, including myself, need to be punished. And so it wasn't until I realized that I start taking steps in my life to get that fixed. I think God wants to do the same thing for you. He cares much more about your character than your comfort. I think our emotions, fear and anger and frustration, those are those dashboard lights in our lives that help us to see that. Do not ignore those. It may mean that you're singing off key. Get together with a trusted friend, family member, or mentor, and see if you can try to figure it out, and be open to the fact that God may be knocking on your door to let you know that you're singing off key. Because as we become self-aware, we pass through the doorway where we can start to really embrace and start working on this idea of character change to become like Christ. Let me pray. Dear God, thank you for the privilege of being part of your family. Thanks that you care so deeply about us. You care much more about our character than our comfort. Help us, Lord, to be open to the fact that you may be knocking on our door. Help us be open to the fact that we may be singing off key and not aware of it. Lord, I pray for the men and women in this room that you would help them to listen when you speak. Help them to hear the things that you have to say, and help them become better people as a result. In Jesus' name, amen.